21-5257 Delek U.S. Holdings, Inc. versus USA. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Kovacev for the appellant.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. In 2004, Congress created a tax incentive regime designed to promote the mixing of alcohol and biodiesel fuel blends while maintaining funding for the Highway Trust Fund. The tax incentive can be taken through one of two different methods, either as a credit to satisfy the taxpayer's fuel excise tax or as a cash payment. It's undisputed that if a taxpayer receives the incentive in the form of a cash payment, the cash payment is not taxed as income. And if a taxpayer then uses that tax-free cash to pay a business expense, for example, state or local taxes, that expense is deductible and the cash is still tax-free. The statute does not provide a different result when the incentive is used to satisfy federal fuel excise tax. Therefore, Delek is entitled to include fuel excise taxes satisfied by the incentive in its cost of goods sold, and the district court's ruling should be reversed. When Congress enacts a tax credit, that credit is not taxable, and it does not reduce any otherwise allowable tax deductions or tax benefits. Unless,
can I ask you a question, just a practical question? We're dealing with tax years 2010 and 2011, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What about the last 10 years? Is this program, have you taken advantage of the program in those years as well? Have you elected to take the payments in cash instead of as credits?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, to answer your question, there are two. There's an alcohol and then there's a biodiesel credit. The alcohol credit expired, I believe, 2011 may have been the last year. The biodiesel credit continues into effect through at least 2022. And Delek has claimed the credit and has received both credits and cash payments, just as they did in 2010 and 2011.
Is there, but you don't agree, I take it, obviously, that you have to take the credits first. And it's not a waterfall where you have to take the credit, then the cash.
No. It's at the option of the taxpayer to use one or the other. Now, there are advantages to having it as an excise tax credit, because you can net that against your semi-monthly deposits. So it's less cash up front throughout the quarter. But no, there's nothing that, there's no ordering rule in the statute. So one could elect one method or the other.
Do you think that, do we have to resolve that question in order to resolve this case, or do we leave it alone? This question about whether you could, in theory, take the cash instead of the credits?
Well, I think certainly you do not need to reach that question if the court concludes that the district court should be reversed and that's all. Because we believe, just based on the statutory language, whether the optionality feature exists or not, the incentive when taken as a credit is still includable in cost of goods sold. I will say that if it is optional, there's no way that the government can make its case, because it would be fundamentally absurd to have an option where you can take cash or you can take a credit and then have this huge disparity of tax treatment, of income tax treatment, and have the taxpayer have a choice.
Okay.
So we've talked a lot about in the briefs about this default exclusion rule, which says that if there's a tax credit, then otherwise applicable tax benefits are not eliminated or reduced unless Congress explicitly says so. And this applies to the incentive at 6426 and 6427, just like it does any other federal tax credit. By way of background, Delek pays hundreds of millions of dollars of fuel excise taxes every year. Now, by law, those fuel excise taxes are offset against taxable income as part of tax of goods sold, which is essentially the same as taking a tax deduction for the amount of those fuel excise taxes, because they're like a business expense. Now, the statute that creates the incentive contains no language expressly stating that fuel excise taxes that are satisfied by applying the incentive through the credit should be treated differently than taxes that are satisfied through cash payments and some semi-monthly deposits. There should be no income tax benefits claimed language or any similar language, which does occur in other places of the code repeatedly. Congress knows how to do this, and it knows how to do it in the excise field too. We cited in our briefs, for instance, section 5041, which is the wine excise tax. And there is in subsection C, there is actually a credit for small domestic wineries. And in that credit, there is an explicit denial of deduction provision that says, if you claim this credit against your excise taxes, then you cannot claim an income tax benefit, like a deduction.
Why do you think that Congress had to clarify then that the highway funding would be made whole, essentially, the 9503 or whatever it is, if it's so clear that it was all that this entire thing was still the tax liability?
Well, first off, you have to go back to the way things were before 2004, before the incentive was enacted. Then there was an exemption regime. So if you had an alcohol fuel blend, you paid a reduced rate of excise tax. That meant that less money went into the highway trust fund as part of that guaranteed source of revenue. Congress knew that that was not what they wanted because they knew that they needed more money for the fund. They still wanted to incentivize alcohol and biodiesel, so they came up with the incentive. That way, the taxpayer gets the credit or the payment as an incentive. The highway trust fund gets the full amount of the credit, and the general fund of the treasury makes up the difference.
Right, but I find that odd. I mean, they get the full amount, the government makes itself whole, essentially, but it's spelled out. And why would you need to, I mean, so they spell it out because it wouldn't be obvious because you're not actually paying that amount of tax, right? I mean, it just seems like it's logical for me to say, well, then your tax liability has been reduced.
Well, Section 9503, from the beginning, from 1956, from the original Highway Act, has always contained that taxes received language. And in fact, it's in every trust fund statute in the codes from 9501 to 9513. So that is the formulation that is used. And the reason for that is because for it to be a trust fund, the point is you want a dedicated source of revenue. You don't want to rely on yearly appropriations. You want to be able to earmark this stream of revenue specifically for this fund. And that's the whole point. So what had to happen in 9503 is we still want to maintain this guaranteed stream of income without relying on yearly appropriation. So we're going to have to keep the taxes received because that's the revenue. We just define it to include both the part that's paid by the taxpayer in cash and the part that is paid by the cash payer through applying the incentive. But there are other examples where the default exclusion rule has applied in both the excise tax and other tax aspects. And the district court held that the default exclusion rule did not apply for excise taxes. We believe that that was an error. And that's because Congress actually does, in the excise tax field, include these denial of deduction provisions, such as in 5041C, which I mentioned earlier. That would be unnecessary surplusage if the government were correct in this case. There would be no reason to have that language in there at all.
Do you think there's a difference, I guess you don't, between taxing something as income and more indirectly allowing you to include it on or not include on a cost of goods sold calculation?
Effectively, no. I mean, economically, it's the same. And under the default exclusion rule, it's the same rule. It's both, you know, those are flip sides of the same coin. A tax credit is not taxable as income. It is also, taking the credit does not reduce your income tax through the back door through reducing some other tax benefit or tax attribute, unless Congress says so.
Let me ask you this question before your time runs out. Does any court actually use the phrase default exclusion rule, or is that something you came up with?
It's something that my colleague, Mr. Morris, came up with as a phrase, but the principle itself has been in the Randall case in the Supreme Court for 30 years. And even before that, there are cases that have applied this rule. So I think that it was a very descriptive phrase to describe what is indisputably the law.
All right, Mr. Alulis, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Paul Alulis on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, in this case, Delek seeks to claim as a cost an item for which it never bore any expenditure. And that's the hub of the entire case. Delek, which wishes to include in its calculation of its costs of goods sold an item for which it never expended any money. And that does not comport with the definition of cost of goods sold and does not comport with Congress's intent when it created the fuel excise exemption, the fuel excise tax credit regime that it put in place in Section 6426. Indeed, as Your Honor, Judge Novanian was just asking my opposing counsel, with respect to payments to the Highway Trust Fund pursuant to Section 9503, Delek itself admits at footnote 9 of its opening brief that that payment is merely the transfer from one pocket of the federal government to the other. And Delek claims that that's not a taxable event to it. But it also is not a payment of any excise tax by Delek. Indeed, to the extent that money is transferred from the general fund to the Highway Trust Fund, representing the amount of Section 6426 credits, which Delek has claimed, it's in fact a transfer of funds that have been paid by other taxpayers into the general fund and then transferred to the Highway Trust Fund. The government is not contending that Delek cannot include its Section 4081 excise tax liabilities in its cost of goods sold. It can, but it can only include the Section 4081 excise tax that it actually pays. And in this case, where Delek claimed Section 6426A excise tax credits, it did not pay that amount of Section 4081 excise taxes.
I take it your position obviously is that they have to take the credits before they take the cash payment, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the structure of the statute.
And you get that from 6426, is that where the shall be allowed language?
Yes, Your Honor, it's the combination of Section 6426A and 6427E1 and E3. 6426A provides that there shall be allowed a credit against the Section 4081 excise tax, and Section 6427E3 provides that no cash payment shall be made for amounts that are allowed as credits pursuant to Section 6426A. That creates the ordering system.
It seems like an odd reading. I mean, I understand there are cases in the tax context that talk about allowed and allowable and shall and whatever, but just kind of looking at it, if something shall be allowed, it seems like it's mandatory that it be permitted, but not necessarily that the person that it's permissive to actually take the benefit of it, is it? I mean, you're saying that shall be allowed means they have to actually take the benefit of the credits before they can take the cash. And I guess it seems an odd reading of those words.
Well, Your Honor, I think some of the confusion may come in because of Delek's claim that there's an optionality here. And Delek argues that there's an option between claiming either the credit or the cash payment. There is an optionality available here, but that's not the optionality. The optionality is a choice between either claiming excise tax credits as allowed by Section 6426 or claiming income tax credits as allowed between Section 40 or Section 40A of the code. That's the optionality that exists. So a taxpayer such as Delek may, if it chooses, elect to claim the Section 6426A excise tax credits. If it does, those credits shall be allowed. And then if there is any excess credit above and beyond the Section 4081 liability that would otherwise be owed, then it may claim a cash payment pursuant to Section 6427E1. Or the taxpayer can claim an income tax credit pursuant to Section 40 for alcohol blends or Section 40A for biodiesel blends. That's the optionality. And the provisions of the income tax credit and the excise tax credit contain provisions which provide that they are either or. So for example, Section 40C, which is the income tax credit for alcohol blends, provides that any income tax credit claimed must be reduced to take into account Section 6426 credits. Section 40AC contains a similar provision, and Section 6426G contains a provision which also provides that the income tax credits and the excise tax credits must be coordinated with each other. So that's the optionality that exists in the statute, either an income tax credit or an excise tax credit. Once the producer, the taxpayer, chooses to go the excise tax credit route, then the operation of Section 6426 and 6427 work together to say, first, what happens is the producer claims the Section 6426 credits against its Section 4081 liabilities, and then any excess credit that may otherwise have been calculated can be claimed as a cash payment.
Counsel, if I understand what you're saying, if a taxpayer tried to do it differently, that would be rejected by the IRS. If they asked for money that they could have gotten as a tax credit, they asked for it as a payment, they would be turned down. Is that right?
Well, they have the option of taking either an income tax credit or an excise tax credit.
I'm saying if they take the excise tax credit, the argument, yes, I think the other side is they can get that money one of two ways. One is by payment and the other is by credit.
Correct.
Right? And your position is, to the extent that they can get it as a credit, they have to take it as a credit. Otherwise, they won't get it. Is that correct?
Correct.
If they're on the excise. So if they tried to do that, if they said, oh, we understand there's an option, then they could either do it or you wouldn't let them do it. And you're saying it's a matter of practice. IRS doesn't allow them to do that. Is that true?
I'm not sure of any cases where that's occurred, Your Honor, but the way that the statutes are written, I think that would be correct, that their accounting should be adjusted so that the 6426 credit is claimed first, and then any cash payment comes afterwards. Yes, Your Honor.
If the other side is right and you're wrong on that, then we should be seeing a lot of activity trying to do it as a payment rather than as a credit.
Well, and I'm not aware, Your Honor, of any situations where that has happened.
Okay, that's what I was asking. Thank you.
Now, an important point to make with respect to this coordination between the income tax credit, which is available, versus the excise tax credit, which is available, is that where a taxpayer claims the income tax credit under Section 40 or Section 40A, that the value of that credit is then includable in the taxpayer's gross income pursuant to Section 87 of the code. Section 87 of the code explicitly provides that gross income includes the income tax credits under Section 40 and 40A. And this has the effect to equalize the income tax benefits with the excise tax benefits for exactly the reason that the government posits the ordering takes place under the excise tax credit regime. When a taxpayer claims excise tax credits, that has the effect of reducing their Section 4081 excise tax liability. Now, as opposing counsel has pointed out, that has a carryover effect in the sense that because their costs of goods sold are lower, that gives them a lower offset to their taxable income for cost of goods sold, which effectively increases their taxable income, and they pay a higher tax because they have a lower deduction. Including the income tax credit in gross income equalizes those same two effects. And so the problem being pointed out by opposing counsel is taken care of in the code by offering the option of the income tax credit as an alternative to the excise tax credit.
And you make that argument in your brief?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. Yes, we do. And that explains how these two schemes were set up to work together. And at the end of the day, what Delek seeks to do here is to claim an offset to its manufacturing expenses, an amount that it never paid. And that's simply not what's allowable under the calculation of cost of goods sold. Now, with respect to some of the other credits where counsel points to other credits and says, oh, well, when Congress wishes to otherwise make a credit not deductible, it says so. They're all distinguishable, and we discussed them in our brief, but just a few examples. Section 45H, the low sulfur diesel fuel credit, that provides a general business credit, income tax credit at Section 38. It does not directly reduce any otherwise allowable deduction. And because of that, Congress enacted another provision, Section 280CD, which brought about that result. Deductions otherwise allowable under this chapter shall be reduced by the amount of the Section 45H credit. But Section 6426, in contrast to that, accomplishes the same effect directly because it mandates that its credit shall be allowed against the Section 4081 excise tax liability. So the 6426 credit directly reduces the Section 4081 excise tax liability. The other credits the council is talking about don't have that effect. Section 46, the past investment tax credit, Section 5011, the distilled spirits credit, all of them are of that same ilk. They don't themselves directly reduce an otherwise deductible expense. And so Congress includes in the statute where it wishes to a provision that causes that effect. But Section 6426 here does directly reduce the Section 4081 expense because it is a credit taken against the Section 4081 expense. Once Delek chooses to take the Section 6426 credit against its Section 4081 excise tax expense, that lowers the expense. And Delek may claim as a cost of goods sold on its tax return that lowered expense, the amount of money that it actually pays in its Section 401 excise tax liability.
Can I ask you about a provision? I'm not sure whether they cited it or not, but 6401B, which talks about the overpayment of income tax, it talks about taxes that are reduced. It has a specific parenthetical that says taxes imposed that are reduced by credits allowable. And it seems like that specific language is not present here. I'm just wondering I don't know if you're familiar with that provision or not, but
I have general familiarity with that provision, Your Honor. I'm not exactly certain how that provision could be seen to impact the calculations here. Unfortunately, I don't have the specific statutory language in front of me in order to analyze it. I'd be happy to send the court a letter after argument addressing that provision if the court would like us to do that.
I don't think it's necessary.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, we believe that ultimately the question really boils down to, can Delek claim as a cost of goods sold a cost which it never incurred because it never paid? And the answer to that question is no. And for that reason, we would ask that this court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Kovacev.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government argued that all the credits that Delek cited, where there was a denial of deduction or similar clause, none of those involved any type of excise tax where there would be a potential for an income tax deduction. That is not true. In our brief, page 46, we cited section 5041, which I talked about earlier. And also we talked about the oil windfall excise tax, both of which would be deductible as excise taxes on a taxpayer's income tax. In both of those cases, Congress enacted a credit for the excise tax. And in both of those cases, Congress felt the need to include a provision explicitly saying, and you cannot take a deduction for any taxes paid for by this tax credit. So, again, if Congress needed to do it in that case, it would also need to do it in this case. And the government suggested that we didn't pay the fuel excise taxes that are satisfied by the incentive. We disagree with that because, the incentive could have been taken as a cash payment. We could have used that to pay state tax. We could have used it to, do any number of business expenses and then taken the deduction and then received the tax-free cash. And that's what the statute clearly allows. And the government has failed throughout to grapple with the fundamental anomaly. How can the cash payment be both tax-free and used for expenses that are deductible for income tax purposes and still be tax-free? And then for the exact same activity, if it's taken as a credit, then it's stripped away of all the income tax benefits that would otherwise apply to paying fuel excise taxes.
Would your, would your position upset this balance that the government's talking about between the way the income tax treatment would be the income tax credits versus taking it as an excise credit?
We don't think there is any kind of, balance necessarily included. There's nothing in the statute that says, oh, and make sure that your excise taxes are equal to the income, tax credit that would apply. Further, Section 87 is directed just to Section 40 and 48. It says you cannot take any income, you have to include these into income. Congress actually knew that it had to say that. There's no provision similar to that in 6426 and 6427. So by that exclusion, we know Congress did not have any intent to change the income tax treatment of payments satisfying fuel income taxes through the credit. And this brings up another point on optionality and the word shall. The government says that the word shall be allowed means that the taxpayer has to take it. The charitable contribution section, section 170, says that there shall be allowed a deduction for donations to qualified charities. So if I go to mass every Sunday, put some money in the collection plate, that's deductible. If I don't report that on a tax return, did I break the law? Of course not. That shall be allowed is directed at the government to tell the IRS that it must permit the credit. And finally,
But in 6427E, the amount allowed language is there as well. So would that similarly be the hypothetical amount that would be allowed? Or would it be the actual credits taken that would that would have to be put in? I mean, don't we have to treat them the same?
Well, here I think is the structure. 6426A says you shall allow credit for these activities in X amount. 6427E1 says government, you actually have to make a payment for that amount. And then the coordination says you can either have it as a credit or cash. So yes, the government has to allow the credit. The credit is then payable. That's what E1 means, in cash, as opposed to taking a tax credit. And then the coordination just means that you can't get cash and get credit for the same, for the same gallon of fuel, which is just common sense.
Right, but 3 says allowed, right? That I'm just saying it says allowed. It doesn't, but you're saying that it means what you actually, you have to coordinate between what you actually took in credits, not what was allowed, but what were you actually elected.
Well, that's what allowed means in the code. And we cited in our reply brief, the Fourth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, the en banc tax court, which have held that allowed versus allowable is a very important distinction. And if it said allowable, that would mean anything that could conceivably have been taken. Right. Allowed means something that you actually did take. That's the distinction.
Okay.
All right, if there are no further questions, leave your times up. We thank you both for your argument. We'll consider the case carefully.